Welcome to Trail Bites for the week of October 7th, 2020. I'm Gavin Jackson. This mini-pod is a companion piece to the South Carolina lead, and we're doing this to help keep you up to speed on what is happening on the campaign trail in the Palmetto State, and what South Carolinians like you are thinking. Before we get into what this episode's about, I want to give you a reminder that the U.S. Supreme Court says if you are voting with an absentee mail-in ballot, you need a witness signature on it. That's right, you heard me correct. I know we've been going back and forth over and over every week, but you need it signed, folks. Not my rules. Supreme Court rules, all right? They rule, right? So go get it signed. You can get a stranger to do it. Anyone. I'd say send it to me, but that'd be more work than it's worth. So, and I'd have to actually witness you, I suppose. I don't want to get involved in your politics. Anyway, get it signed. Now, this Trail Bite features an in-depth look at two recent debates. The first, South Carolina Senate debate between Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democratic challenger Jamie Harrison. We also look at the second and final debate between 1st Congressional District Democrat Joe Cunningham and Republican State Representative Nancy Mace. A lot to get through, which is why I have brought back Caitlin Bird, who covers the South Carolina 1st Congressional District for the state newspaper, and Joe Bustos, who is covering the Senate race also for the state newspaper. Welcome to you both, and a special welcome to you, Joe. First time on the lead. Here we are.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here with all y'all. Before we get into the debate and dissecting that, we got a fresh update from the Cook Political Report Wednesday morning that moved the Senate race to a toss-up from lean Republican. Now, Cook defines toss-up as the most competitive. Either party has a good chance of winning that race. And I want to quote you really quick Jessica Taylor's lead on this story. She says, "There has been no more surprising race on the Senate map than South Carolina. Even early this year, it looked like Senator Lindsey Graham would cruise to re-election. Instead, the Republican incumbent finds himself in a tied race in both public and private surveys with challenger Jamie Harrison, who has proven to be perhaps Democrats' best recruit and a fundraising behemoth." Joe, you just cranked out an early morning story on this. Tell me a little bit more about this and what's going on with the state of play in the Senate race.
I think one of the interesting things in that analysis by Cook was the amount of money that's being spent by both sides and just how much Jamie Harrison and Democrats are spending on this Senate race. I think it was $68 million by Harrison and his Democratic allies. Graham and his Republican allies have only spent $37 million on this race, where it's north of $100 million. I've got my TV on in the evening and you're watching an hour's worth of television in the 7 o'clock hour, and every commercial break, there are multiple commercials about this race. You cannot get away from Graham or Harrison anywhere you turn, unless you're watching Netflix.
Or public broadcasting, Joe.
Okay, public broadcasting.
Yeah, I have to.
Shots fired on the
just
first
watch TV.
I think that might be my next the next thing is just what's going on with public. Just watch public broadcasting to get away from for a little bit, even though I have to cover it and have to see what
exactly
is happening. So one of the things I've been thinking about is like, I moved to South Carolina in November. But I knew who Lindsey Graham is. And Lindsey Graham is a national figure who either people really like or really hate. And a lot of the money is coming in from outside the state just because of Lindsey Graham. And that's what I find fascinating about this race. And that's why it's getting so much attention and so much ad play. And that's why it's become the ads seem to be having playing a role. Having a good effect right now for Harrison just by the public polling. There's two Quinnipiac polls had him tied at 48. CBS has this race at 45-44 Graham. So it's tight and it's going to be close all the way to the end of election day, it seems like.
And Kevin, if you want to jump in too, I mean, I just want to say another thing talking about spending. The Senate, in that article, it said that the Senate Leadership Fund has come in to help bail out Graham to the tune of $10 million so far spent or reserved through Election Day. So it just kind of shows just how truly in danger this GOP's majority is at this point. What were your takeaways from this Cook Political Report that came out today?
I mean, it's really remarkable. I have been here since January of 16, and I could have never imagined in my understanding of South Carolina politics when I got here, and as I have stayed here, that we would ever see a toss-up race on a Republican, you know, Senate, a strong Republican seat here in South Carolina. Like, a toss-up on a statewide race like this is almost unfathomable. I cannot express that point enough. Ever since 18, you know, Democrats here in the state have been claiming that that blue wave that happened in the midterm races and that we've seen happen in even some state house races and some state Senate seat races, that this was a sign of things to come, that Democrats are really making inroads in South Carolina, that this isn't a fluke, this isn't a one-off election. And now that this Cook Political Report has deemed this race of all races to be a toss-up, Democrats are just dancing in their shoes right now. This is what they really want to see. I cannot imagine the look on Drew McKissick's face when that report came out. He is the chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party, and this has been a historically Republican state. So I just cannot underscore enough how massive of a change this is. I don't know how often people really think about these national prognosticators, but often these people who are working for Cook and other entities, they're getting polls out that we aren't seeing. And so for them to make this change is really remarkable.
Yeah, and especially before we get into the debate, you know, you talk about, you know, we do obviously have shifting demographics in our state. You look back to 2014 when Graham won by 17%, you know, some 200,000 votes. Then, you know, it's going to be important to kind of see how that shifts, you know, if we're going to really see people maybe vote for Donald Trump and not vote for Lindsey Graham, or what that's going to look like. Because, you know, unless we're getting, I keep saying, unless we get, you know, these out-of-state voters with this out-of-state money, it's still going to be something to watch. I mean, it's going to be very close, I feel like. And that's going to be, I guess, the biggest takeaway from this election, that just how close things are and what that means going forward, I would say.
Graham has easily won re-election. I mean, the seat was previously held by Strom Thurmond. So it's going to be fun to watch on election night to see how close it is. I'm wondering, when some of these Quinnipiac polls and CBS polls, they have Graham polling lower than Trump. It's how many, I wonder how many people will vote for Trump and then leave the Senate race blank, or how many will vote for Trump and still vote for Bill Bledsoe, who, even though he endorsed Graham, is still on the ballot and will remain on the ballot. That's something I'm really interested in. I don't know how many people will actually vote Trump-Harrison, but it's, I think what will be interesting to see is how many people vote for Trump but not for Graham.
And just so let's go into the debate from last Saturday between Harrison and Graham from Allen University. You were actually part of the panel that questioned the two in conjunction with reporters from Gray television stations across the state. Just tell me what stood out to you in that first matchup. We'll get into a few different things, but what were some of the big takeaways for you from that first meeting?
Yeah, one of the first things I noticed while just sitting in the audience and getting ready to ask my questions is how Graham would pivot a question about COVID into an answer about the Supreme Court. He had lots of talking points that he wanted to make sure he got in to rally his base. He kept mentioning, we're going to have a conservative Supreme Court once we get Amy Barrett onto the court. And he talks about socialism and AOC, stuff that will rally conservative voters in South Carolina. Harrison was really good about talking about Graham's record and trying to show him as ineffective in the Senate, even though he's been there for almost 18 years now. I think those are some of the key points that I took away after rewatching parts of it last night, just to make sure I had some good notes on this.
Well, Caitlin, I want to bring you in too, because it was interesting. We had a little bit of a 2020 crossover here when Graham was talking about how he supported the bill to get unemployment benefits going to people, but he didn't mention, at least the first time, about how he was originally against, you know, setting that $600 extra payment to folks. because it was going to incentivize them not to go back to work. He even invoked Congressman Joe Cunningham in his stance on these benefits. And I want to play a clip, a really quick clip for you before you weigh in here.
And I supported the phase three, but I said then that if you pay people more not to work than to work, you're going to have a problem. And it turned out to be true. Joe Cunningham understands, the Democrat in Charleston. It's been really hard on hotels and restaurants to get back in business when you're paying people more to be unemployed than to be employed.
So, Kaylin, 2020 crossover right there, and we got some in the first congressional debate too, but what was it like to see that kind of maybe support or invoking someone from the other party like that?
Well, I mean, I thought it was really, really interesting. I don't read it as support because Senator Graham has been going around the state and very much one of his talking points when he is asked about Joe Cunningham or when I asked him about the race down here in the first is Joe Cunningham's a nice guy, but Joe Cunningham's a really nice guy. I like him, but he's a Democrat or, you know, he's just not right for the Lowcountry. So when I heard Senator Graham bring that point up, I thought he was more trying to make sure that he is reaching voters who are in Cunningham's district, that invoking Cunningham, maybe he recognizes that there were some people who maybe voted for Governor Henry McMaster last time in the 18 race, but then didn't vote for Republican Katie Arrington, who was running against Joe Cunningham in the open seat that was previously held by Mark Sanford. So I don't know. When I heard that, it was an interesting take because I was sort of expecting him to turn it into more of a slam or more of his usual presentation of he's nice, but. So that was a little surprising. And then to your point, yes, we did hear Joe Cunningham last night talking about unemployment benefits and how, no, he does not want to. He actually agrees with Senator Graham and also Senator Scott, for the record, on this matter, that he does not want to see people making more money on unemployment than if they were working. So it's actually a rare point where Republicans and Democrats do agree, or at least these Republicans and this Democrat, I should say.
Yeah. And there were a few times when, you know, Graham's audio was kind of bad. There was a lot of technical issues that we were hearing on TV and it was a bit muddled. And at one point he even like misspoke a few times. At one point he said Obama instead of Trump when he was talking about accepting the nomination as he worked to get another jab in about angry mobs, something that he referenced multiple times, trying to focus on that law and order vote. And of course, getting the judiciary. And like Joe, you were talking about trying to work that into almost all the responses. But a big attack of the night was from Harrison, who hit Graham on changing his word when it came to Supreme Court appointments during an election year. And this is something that has garnered a lot of attention nationally and, of course, money as well for Harrison. So listen to this 2.5-minute clip of the back and forth right here.
Yeah, I said in August, if an opening comes about, we'll see what the market will bear. Ms. Barrett's going to get confirmed because the president has the constitutional authority to do it. And here's what I can say about judges. When President Obama was president, I honored the fact that he won the election, and I voted for two people I wouldn't have chosen. And I've watched the Democratic Party try to destroy one conservative judge after another. Mr. Harrison encouraged the filibuster of Judge Gorsuch, the first partisan filibuster in the history of the United States Senate. He cheered on the destruction of Brett Kavanaugh. All I can say is that Amy Barrett is highly qualified. I'm the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. The president has every right to do this. And if you're counting on Mr. Harrison to ever vote for a conservative judge, you're making a mistake of high proportion.
Stubbs, listening to Senator Graham is like, it reminds me of playing Monopoly with my son. You change the rules, he changes the rules every time he gets. You know, Senator, you said, use my words against me. And you said it after the Kavanaugh meetings, not before the Kavanaugh hearings, after the Kavanaugh hearings. And your words, your promise was that no judicial nominee should be considered or approved or what have you in the last year of an election. And you even named President Trump when you said it. And so this is my thing. You know, my grandfather always taught me, he said, Jamie, a man is only as good as his word. Well, Senator, how good is your word when you made a promise to the American people? And even more, you made a promise to the folks in South Carolina that you wouldn't be doing what you're doing right now. And that's the problem that I have. The greatest, I think the greatest heresy that you could do as a public servant is to betray the trust of the people that you are, you took an oath to serve. And that's what you have done.
So it seemed like a pretty big line right there from Harrison. I think one that everyone was kind of waiting to see how it was going to play out because that has been such a focus, right, Joe? I mean, it seemed like it landed pretty well. And, you know, Harrison, given the fact that he hasn't run for office before, seemed to kind of hold his own against Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, I mean, the one advantage or disadvantage that Graham has is he's got a record. It's also, it could be both an advantage and a disadvantage. It's what I'm saying. He's said certain things and then has reversed his position. I think later in the debate, Harrison even had a really good line. I will never, never, never lie to you. I'm not going to go back on my word. And it's good contrast to saying, hey, Senator Graham has reversed his position from 2 years ago when it comes to Supreme Court judges. So he's just, it's an effective line of showing Graham has changed his position over time on certain issues.
Yeah. And Kaylin, if you want to jump in too, you know, we heard Harrison hammering on about COVID-19. You know, he even had his own plexiglass partition, which just blew up social media, blew up the news media. I mean, we're seeing that there's going to be plexiglass now on the debate stage of the vice presidential debate. Who knows if it's related, but it started here first, folks. That's what Trav Robertson said. And, but, you know, we saw him hitting back about, you know, the Senate should be passing a COVID relief package instead of rushing through a judge. But as Jessica Taylor points out, of course, and like a lot of people have pointed out, you know, it seems like this is going to be his Hail Mary, Graham's Hail Mary, with these Senate hearings next week to really kind of maybe make up and break away a little bit from these tight polls. What's your take on that?
I think that Jessica Cook is an incredibly smart individual, and I think she's hit the nail on the head. We have to remember that Lindsey Graham was not always so beloved amongst his Republicans. In fact, during those previous Senate challenges that you were talking about, people were, Republicans in particular, were questioning whether or not Lindsey really represented them enough, whether he was conservative enough, whether he was Republican enough to represent South Carolina at the U.S. Senate. And then the Kavanaugh hearings happened, and that changed everything for Senator Graham. That became his go-to story on the trail. He would use that if he was campaigning for himself, if he was campaigning for others, if he was speaking at a dinner, if he was speaking at a lunch, if he was talking to the press, if he was talking to the public. The Kavanaugh hearings were the story that he loved to retell and that Republicans loved to hear. They loved to hear about Lindsey's big moment in the Kavanaugh fights. So now, potentially, he could be setting himself up for another big national spotlight moment. He's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary. The power is in his gavel. This is a major issue. We've got less than 30 days to go until the November election. The time is running out on many issues, on many fronts, and there's nothing that seems to have galvanized the Republican base quite like conservative judges and the need to get them installed no matter what happens in November, but to get them installed way before November if possible. So I think you're right. I think Jessica's right that you know, Senator Graham really sees a political opportunity here to make good on his promise to appoint and approve and confirm as many conservative judges as he possibly can. And if he can get another SCOTUS judge approved, then wow, he's done his job as the Senate Judiciary Chairman.
And kind of along those lines, Joe, I want to point out, you know, we did see some glimmers of bipartisan Graham during this debate as well. You know, he talked about voting for Obama's SCOTUS picks, you know, saying that his fair approach will be one of his legacies, that he has the scars to prove it. He even referenced his Grahamnesty nickname from talk radio, referring to his immigration stances. But I was shocked a few times that he didn't take several rebuttals against Harrison, who hit him on his previous statement from his House days on term limits and also on previously supporting offshore drilling. And then, of course, Graham was denied a rebuttal regarding his Senate record, apparently due to time. So I want to kind of get your final thoughts on what we heard from that debate. And, of course, we have one coming up. So thoughts from that debate, finally, and then, of course, what to expect maybe going forward this Friday.
Yeah, I've been thinking about what's going to happen Friday. One thing that I've found out after the debate, with just the amount of viewership it had, C-SPAN had clips as it's the clip of the debate has been viewed 57,000 times on its website, which is a strong number. And in Spartanburg, 41,000 households watched the debate on a Saturday night while Clemson football was playing against Virginia. So I wonder how much does Harrison continue on trying to show he's a moderate candidate, trying to show that he's not the social, he's not connected to social ultra liberal causes that Graham is seeking to show. And does Graham also try to show again, like, yeah, I have worked across the aisle, and does he show that he's proud of working across the aisle? And when he can't find times he could agree with people on the Democratic side. I think that's going to be the key thing for the next debate. Mm-hmm.
And we did see, you know, you're talking about that national audience. We did see that Jamie Harrison's campaign said that, you know, he raised $1.1 million from that debate that night. You know, during, after, altogether $1.1 million just from that debate. So, I mean, that just shows, again, that interest. And then, of course, you know, even Graham brought up the worry about all the money pouring in from that raise. So, Keon, did you have any final thoughts on the debate or what to expect that you're going to be watching for? Or do you want to jump right into the first congressional district?
I say let's get into the first.
Okay. Well, from toss-up to lean Democrat, we go to the first congressional district debate. Tuesday night was the final debate between Cunningham and Mace. And while we heard a lot of rehashing from the first debate, there were some differences in the attacks and the messaging. And Kaylin, I want to read the lead of your story in the state. And that is, in the final congressional debate before Election Day, both Republican Nancy Mace and Democrat Joe Cunningham were put on the spot about President Donald Trump. Is he a uniter or a divider? Instead, they dodged the question. Now, this debate definitely had way more to do with Trump than the first one. So what, again, tell us what you reported on, what stood out to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for reading the lead. We actually spent a lot of time in those first sentences, so I appreciate the verbatim recognition because, wow, you're tired. You would not believe what an hour can take out of a human being. Yeah. But yeah, the reason why I really, we wanted to point that out is because this, the first congressional district is a coastal region that in 2016 overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. He got the advantage by 13 percentage points. And yet here we are, you know, 4 years later in the middle of this congressional race in this newfound battleground district, by the way, where when the candidates were given the opportunity to defend or maybe go on the attack about the president, who's become very much a lightning rod figure in American politics, both of them sort of tried to skirt the question. In particular, that was quite interesting for Nancy Mace, who actually worked on President Donald Trump's campaign from September of 15 until August of 16. Cunningham tried, who has very much made his pitch to voters for the last couple of years, painting himself very much as a bipartisan voice or an independent voice for the Lowcountry, has said, you know, that he would agree with the president where they agreed, and then he would voice opposition where they disagreed. We had a little bit of like audio difficulty, so it was tough to hear what Nancy Mace actually said in the beginning of her question, but then she kind of decided to go on the attack and question Cunningham's claims of bipartisanship, saying he's not moderate, you know, and if this is independent, then we've set a new low bar. So I was surprised that she didn't at least give some sort of a qualifier or say he's a uniter where it counts or something like that. But neither of them answered that straight up question. You know, is he this or is he that? I thought it was a really strong question for the moderators to ask because it really did put them on the spot. And it also, to that point, it shows that both of the candidates in that moment in time when they had the opportunity to talk about Trump, they did not see a political advantage to do so. And that's fascinating, again, because remember, this is technically this is Trump country here in the first district, though it was not as strong when you compare it to the other congressional districts in that year.
And we also heard Cunningham walk a fine line about getting another COVID relief bill through the Senate, while President Trump also tweeted out earlier in the day that he was pulling out of negotiations until after the election. And that came to the dismay of Democrats and Republicans. So I want to play this clip for you really quick of Joe Cunningham talking about those negotiations and the president.
Before walking in here tonight, I saw the tweet from the president saying that he'd called off negotiations for another stimulus package. And he said that he's directing the Senate to instead focusing on the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. I think that's the wrong move. I think that all, you know, both chambers of Congress should be dedicated to passing another stimulus package. Instead, the Senate is focused on ramrodding in another Supreme Court justice. And that's probably where my opponent and I differ. Look, another stimulus package is needed, and it's needed desperately. I talk to people every single day. Businesses, they're struggling to keep their doors open. We've already seen too many of our best restaurants in Charleston close their door. You know, whether it be Cane Rum Bar, Justine's Kitchen downtown. Too many people are suffering and they need relief. And colleges and universities are no different.
So, Kaylin, right there, kind of really walking that fine line, like I was saying, about really trying not to attack too hard, but show the need is there and humanize that need.
Yeah. And then, you know, we woke up today and we saw that the president had kind of changed his tune on that stimulus need. So it's been very much a moving target. But yeah, both of the candidates actually seem to very much try to walk that fine line of trying to recognize that their district here may not be as supportive of the president as it once was. But at the same time, wanting to pay deference or at least acknowledge areas where they do agree with the commander in chief, where they do think they can work together, because both of them are effectively trying to make the same pitch to voters, but in very different ways. Though one is a Democrat and one is a Republican, more than anything, both of them want to be seen as bipartisan. More than anything, both of them want to be communicating to Lowcountry voters that they represent their values, though neither has really explained exactly what Lowcountry values are. Both of them want to be more independent, which this district has definitely had representation in the past that has kind of danced and whistled to its own tune in the past. So they're having to walk a really interesting line here in a historically Republican district that may not be the national Republican that people think, or that may not be necessarily in lockstep with every single issue of the president, like it is in some parts of the country. The first district is really weird. I try to explain that to people all the time, because on paper it looks very simple. But, you know, the easiest way that I kind of explain it is that when you talk to people around here, 9 times out of 10, they'll tell me that they're a conservative as opposed to telling me that they're a Republican. And I ask about that difference, and they say it's because Republicans tend to be more representative of the values that they believe in, but that they aren't necessarily straight party people.
And Kaylin, when we're talking about bipartisanship too, Paris Island was a huge topic. You know, Mace continued to try and tie Cunningham to putting the Marine Corps training base on the chopping block because of a previous defense spending bill vote, which he said was not the case and was also supported by Republicans in the delegation. He even turned this into an example of how he is being bipartisan by working with Senator Graham, and he even gave him a shout out, kind of reciprocating what we were talking about there with the Senate debate. So the Paris Island debate, you know, how did that shake out on the debate stage?
So this was a line of attack that Representative Mace first deployed in the first debate, but she didn't really elaborate on too much. Since that first debate, she has not only held multiple press conferences about the issue, she started running a new campaign ad on TV about it, accusing Joe Cunningham of supporting liberal California lawmakers to insert this amendment into a massive spending bill that has, in her words, put Paris Island on the chopping block. This assessment is something that the offices of Senators Graham and Scott have disagreed with and have gone on record disagreeing with. Representative Joe Wilson, who's on the House Armed Services Committee, has also disagreed with her characterization of Representative Cunningham's support of this bill and what that vote for the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, actually did. But Nancy Mace, even after that fact check came out, even after both of her fellow Republican U.S. senators who are supporting her in this race, for the record, and recently stood with her at a unity event, even after they basically refuted what Nancy is saying, Nancy doubled down on that even more in this debate, consistently attacking Joe Cunningham about this topic of Paris Island, trying to tie it to a failure of leadership on Joe's part, tying it to him not really paying attention closely enough for what these effects could be when these major bills are passed. The problem is that no one predicted that this was going to be happening. This was a no analysis or CBO look that's done on major bills like this, when they say, okay, this is how much this will cost, this is the impact, this is what we're projecting. This projection of closing Paris Island was never in there. This is something that came about when the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps said that in an interview with the Military Times that this requirement to have co-ed training in the next 5 years at Paris Island could potentially put Paris Island on the chopping block. He didn't say chopping block, but I'm saying chopping block because that's what I've been hearing for the last 2 weeks. So even though Nancy has been fact-checked on this, she's continued to double down on it. Her campaign sees this as a successful issue, a strong talking point. The first congressional district does have the highest concentration or percentage of veterans of any other district in South Carolina. So it is a smart strategy on paper to be appealing to a dereliction of duty, as she has put it. But whether or not that's actually a fair brushstroke is definitely questionable and has been challenged.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to wrap up really quick too, Kaylin, and just point out that, you know, we did see kind of a different a tagline from Nancy Mace as well. She didn't really push that single working mom line as much last night. It was a bit more refined. She referenced it too. But there was a back and forth where Joe Cunningham, who actually used one of his rebuttals because they were limited to about three rebuttals, where he actually reminded folks that he was a working father. And you know, when he goes to Washington, his wife is, you know, basically a single working mom. Obviously, he's there to support when he needs to. But it seemed like he finally kind of had a comeback for that line, which was just hammered during the first debate. Any thoughts about maybe the shift there and addressing it?
Yeah, it definitely seemed like Cunningham did find his line to respond without necessarily devaluing what Nancy was saying, which is a difficult thing to do because you certainly don't want to discredit anyone who is a working parent. And both of them are. So that was a really tricky and fine line that he walked. But I will say that just watching this, there was a lot more tension between the two of the candidates on this debate stage, the second go round. They only had a week and a day in between. So there wasn't much downtime for them, if you're thinking about it. But it did seem like some of the attacks did get more personal. We heard a lot more accusations from both candidates, this time of the other being a liar or lying or distorting their record or being incapable of telling the truth. That was something we didn't see as much of blatantly in the first debate. Because of that rebuttal rule that was in place in this one, it was very interesting to try and watch and see sort of what the strategy would be, because you have to make specific strategic choices about what's worth your time. And Nancy Mace actually did use some of her time to kind of hammer home this point of being a working single mother. And she even used one of her rebuttals to directly address women who were watching to say, you know, don't be discouraged. If you can dream it, you can do it. We have to have more women run for office, because if more women don't run, then we can't win. Even though there was no discourse during the debate about whether or not more women should or shouldn't be running for office. But Nancy is very much has taken a lot of these attacks to be more personal in nature. But again, so has Joe. So it was for all of the back and forth and all of the more personal attacks that we did see, even though it was largely on the same themes from the first go round, they did end up in some agreement. The last question of the night, they were asked, do you support gay marriage? And they both said yes, without elaborating. Easiest question in quotes of the night. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And Dean Stevens said, something we can agree on.
Yeah. And that was a carryover too from a previous question when they didn't address it, right? So it was like, right, Let's get back and make sure you hold them to it. That's, again, one of those tricky things you have to do as a debate moderator. Make sure that they at least try and answer the questions when they get them. But again, that was the last debate for the SCO1 race. So you can watch that online from ABC4 News. And then, of course, we'll be watching for the upcoming Senate debate this Friday night, which we'll tell you more details about in a second. So just want to thank you guys again, Caitlin Bird and Joe Bustos with the State Newspaper. Thank you guys for making some time and for your reporting.
No, thank you, Gavin. Really appreciate being able to unpack this, because it's not just an hour. There's so much more that goes into it with these debates. So thank you.
Definitely.
Thanks, Gavin. It's good to be on.
All right, folks, again, great discussion right there. Hope you enjoyed it. And I want to make you aware of another Senate debate coming our way. Nexstar Media Group, in partnership with the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce, hosts the next Senate debate Friday at 7 p.m. You can watch this live on the following stations: WSPA in Spartanburg, Greenville, Anderson, WCBD in Charleston, Berkeley, Dorchester, WBTW in Myrtle Beach, Florence, WSAV in Hilton Head, Beaufort, and Aiken, and WMYT in Charlotte, York, Chester, Lancaster, and Chesterfield. Whew! Also, it will air on WLTX here in Columbia, which is a media partner with SPA. So check it out. We'll be recapping it next week for sure. But that debate is, the next Senate debate is Friday at 7 p.m. And also tell us about your voting experiences. Polls are open, in-person absentee, mail-in ballot. We want to know. Tell us who you're voting for if you want to, what your top issues are. Heck, just tell us about your experience. We want to know. This is different times. Leave us a message, 803-563-7169. Leave us your name if you want to, where you're calling from, and just talk about voting for us. We're all about voting. You can also follow me on Twitter at Gavin Jackson for candidate updates and for great story links and just the latest on what's going on in South Carolina. And a reminder, Campaign Trail Bites is not biased toward any candidate or campaign. We're just covering these candidates as they make themselves available and as we can get to them. We're out there trying to get you as much information so you can make your own decision in 2020. And we'll bring you a mini pod every time there's campaign trail activity in the state, aka every week until November 3rd. Maybe even after November 3rd. Anyway, let us know. Follow us on Twitter, SCLeadPod, and on Instagram with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. Campaign Trail Bites is a production of the South Carolina Lead. I'm Gavin Jackson.